sabrosura pa ti que.
Hello everyone, this is Pam, the Cafe con Pam, the bilingual podcast that features Latine and people of the global majority who break barriers, change lives, and make the world a better place. Welcome to episode 345 of Cafe con Pam. Today, we have a conversation with Yanela Vickers. Yanela is a program specialist during the week, critical care EMT on the weekends, but the most fulfilling role, a mother of two teenagers, wife to an amazing law enforcement officer, and a passionate and dedicated advocate for health equity, empowerment, and serve as a voice for the voiceless. Driven by her own walk of life, Yanela escaped and migrated to America when she was five, when her family fled Cuba, bringing her with rich cultural knowledge and resiliency. Her continued public work, along with healthcare in the EMS arena, she's gripped her skills into advocacy based on her personal challenges at such a young age. Through challenges while facing many obstacles, she's turned all those circumstances to positivity by illuminating real-life experiences for minority women and those impacted by similarity and shared experiences. Listeners, this conversation with Yanela was pretty cool because I got to learn a lot about our hearts, and I actually got to share a little bit about my experience I had last year, almost to the year as of the time when this episode is releasing, and how I dealt with my own experience with my heart at the hospital, and I landed at the hospital last year, March 2023. And so prepping for this conversation with Yanela, I got to learn a lot about women and their heart. And one statistic that it really blew my mind is that Hispanic and Latinas develop a heart condition 10 years earlier than other demographic of women. And so because the majority of us here are part of that demographic, I highly recommend you checking into your heart and making sure that everything is well, because we don't want things to happen unexpectedly. Always make sure that we prioritize our health. Y bueno, sin más, aquí está mi conversación con Yanela. Welcome, Yanela, to Café con Pam. ¿Cómo estás? How are you?
I'm good. Bien. Excited.
I'm excited too. So the question that we always ask is, what is your heritage?
So I am Cuban, Cuban born, and pretty much migrated to Florida when I was five.
Wow. So you did spend some time in Cuba.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, I think migrated is an understatement. I think the proper word is escaped.
Yeah, sure. Do you remember?
I do. Not everything, of course, because obviously I was so little. But for the most part, I do have a lot of very vague memories. They're not the best memories, but I do remember a lot of the tougher times.
For sure. I think the Cuban experience is a different experience from the people that cross by land, you know, that migrate by land. Yes. Because you literally have an ocean in between that you have to cross, and it's very different. And I don't know if it's talked about enough how different it is.
No, I really don't think it's talked about enough. And I think sometimes, you know, of course, with the same stigmas around immigrants that cross via land, I think it's the same thing for, you know, immigrants that cross through the ocean. But I think there's a little bit more of a danger to the ocean, because once it swallows you, there's like no going back. It's not like they can't find you unless you're floating or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a lot. And I mean, there's dangers on every part of the migration process. Is it a process? I don't know if that's the proper word, but you know, the journey that migrants go through when they decide to come to the US. And I think, you know, there's, like you shared, a lot of stigma around it. And I don't think we need to ignore the realities and the dangers that people put themselves through.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, overall, I think it's such a sad journey and it's such a traumatic journey. There's no absolute way of kind of trying to regress or even like put that in the back of your head, because the experience is just so deep. It's like really rooted inside of you. You hear so many like tragic stories of people that didn't make it. And then you hear the success stories that people did make it. But at the same time, some of them get repatriated back. And it's a lot. It's really unfortunate. But, you know, sometimes people just think about the selfishness of the whole influx of immigration versus the reality of what people are facing in their home countries. Like, there's no way of living. There's no future. And that's why we do what we do to come here to the United States.
I mean, literally put your life in full danger, because it's more of a window of opportunity to put yourself life in danger than it is to stay, which is wild to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. Well, so you're five, you come to the US, where do you land?
So we ended up residing in Miami for about a couple of months, like close to a year, because my father had a couple of friends over there that gave us shelter and housing. And then essentially we migrated to Palm Beach County. And then, you know, my parents divorced and I ended up, you know, living with my mother. And then my brother ended up living with my father. And pretty much the remainder of our lives has been in Palm Beach County, up until at least for me, like 5 years ago. I relocated a little further north of South Florida to St. Lucie County because we built our home up here. But apart from that, we've been Floridians for most of our lives.
Wow. So let's fast forward a little bit and let's fast forward to your high school time. One, you went back to Cuba around that time.
I did. I went back to Cuba. It was like the beginning of my first semester of high school, because most of my family is still over there. We went over there to see my brother. I was pregnant. I was a little wild one during my high school years. So I ended up finding out that I was pregnant. I did get the clearance to go to Cuba, because of course you have to get approval by your doctor. I go over there super excited to like revisit my homeland, see my family after like over a decade long of, you know, not being over there. And I'm in my first trimester, pregnant, doing my thing. And like next thing you know, I'm in the campo, you know, the farm where my family is mostly at all the time. And I look down and I'm like, uh-oh, I'm bleeding. What is going on? It's my first pregnancy too. So everything was like a little bit of a scare. And just, I was so oblivious. I was young, you know, teen, expectant teen. And my family immediately rushed me to the hospital over there, which, mind you, the hospitals over there are so poor and in like really bad conditions. There's no windows. There's cats in the ER.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And you know, because we were coming from the United States, we got a little better treatment, of course, over there. And then they did an ultrasound and they basically said, your baby is like really low in the uterus. You need to go on bed rest the rest of your trip. Nothing crazy. Don't eat nothing out of the ordinary that can trigger more stress to your body. And so I did that. I pretty much, you know, kind of spent the rest of my trip bored out of my life and my family kind of hovering over me, making sure that I was good and just playing helicopter the whole time. And Pam, I came back to the United States after 2 weeks and immediately I kind of resume prenatal care.
Bueno, wait a minute before you get there. So you're 17.
Mm-hmm.
How does your family take that you're pregnant?
I wouldn't say that they were 100% like happy, because, you know, the whole, you know, I think every Latino has this aspiration of when it comes to America, you're going to go to school, you're going to get a college degree, and you're just going to thrive after that. You're going to either be a nurse, a doctor, like this really high-end career, right? So when they found out that I was expecting, they were like, what the hell? come on, you should know better, blah, blah, blah. And, but I think after a while, when I, especially when I started showing, they were just like, okay, this is reality. Yeah, it's real. She's pregnant. Like, we're not gonna really help her out by beating her down and shaming her. So might as well just jump on the bandwagon and really support her and be there for her, because this is gonna be a very new to her. And yeah, they eventually just buttered up. And honestly, they got to the point where they were just more ecstatic and thrilled that they were gonna be grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins and all that. That they got over the whole, oh my gosh, she's pregnant, she's a teen mom, she's gonna be a teen mom.
For sure. Okay, so I'm glad they came around. Usually it happens, you know, which is a good thing. So you're in Cuba, they put you in bed rest. You're bored with your trip. You come back. They give you the clearance, I guess, to travel back. Well, I guess you kind of had to because
Yeah,
you know.
I had no choice.
Right. What happens after?
So, mind you, I'm still in high school. I just took a quick, that trip was during spring break. I'm still in high school. And of course, there was that stigma too of being, you know, pregnant in high school. Everybody was always staring and just kind of like, oh my gosh, she's pregnant, blah, blah. So, I started going to school just feeling like absolute death. I mean, I remember there was days where I couldn't even get out of bed. And I used to tell my kid's father, like, I can't. And he's over here, like, being supportive and just pushing me to just hurry up and finish and just graduate. And it was just so bizarre because there was this one particular day where I go to shower and I feel like I'm about to pass out. I literally have like this drop in my body where, you know, at the time I didn't know it was just like hypotension. And I held on to like the shower curtain. I'm like, oh my God. And I started like yelling for help. And I was rushed to the ER. And Pam, kid you not, like almost every week after that was in and out of the ER.
What did they say when you first landed after that shower? You were rushed. Did they give you answers?
No, and that's the whole frustrating part about this entire journey with that first pregnancy was just it was always doctors and nurses and even some specialists too and obstetrics and gynecology that would say that all my signs and symptoms were attributed to, you know, morning sickness or just my first pregnancy. But I think, you know, it was that one last ER visit where I got so fed up. And I remember just looking down at my belly and I'm like, I should not be this big. Like my belly was massive. I was not even halfway through my second trimester and I looked full term and if anything, bigger than full term. My legs were so swollen, my gosh. They just felt bulky. And here I am going through all this and still in high school and barely like having a passing grade in school. For lack of a better word, I think my teachers, you know, had a sense of empathy and just supported me and just gave me even work to take home because I became so sick. It got to the point that I remember I went to the doctor that last time. And by this time, you know, because you were already in your second trimester, and if you go through the ER, they move you upstairs to the maternity ward, to the triage up there. And they're like, oh my God, this girl again. Because I'm telling you, every week I would in and out.
And
And
it was all because you felt like you were passing out.
it was all because I was passing out. I was having like this rushing, abdominal pain. Then at one point they said that it wasn't pain associated with nothing. They said that it was because the baby was like literally riding my ribs tight. And I knew that I truly don't think this is that. I started getting migraines too, which, oh my goodness, it was a rippling effect of symptoms that I just couldn't take it anymore. But anyhow, that last particular ER visit, they finally did like a really thorough ultrasound. And I remember after like just laying there in agony and just, I felt so defeated at that point. The attending OBG was like, Yanela, your actual obstetrics physician needs to see you and the doctor ASAP in the morning. We already called them. He's going to be waiting for you. Don't worry about getting an appointment. So I'm like, okay, what is going on? He's like, well, because I'm not your doctor, I'd rather turn your case over back to him and he can further explain what is going on and where to go from there. So once again, I leave the ER, I go home. And mind you, let me go back a little bit because I think I'm leaving out a key point to this story too. Like before I was sent upstairs and the ER downstairs to help me with the pain, they would give me morphine.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they would give me morphine, like low doses, but it was still morphine. And I was very pregnant.
Yeah.
That was a very interesting call. And again, very oblivious, didn't know whether that was good or bad at the time. Now it's a whole different story now.
Listeners, as you know, I'm a recovering procrastinator. And because of that, I'm often building ways to getting things done. Inside the annual Manny's Pass, we get to embrace our own unique ways of achieving. Together in our weekly office hours and cafecitos, we'll find strength in our differences, accountability in our goals, and power in our voices as we heal our inner child through coaching and tapping. Your choice. Let's redefine productivity on our terms. Visit cafecompam.com/Manny's Pass and join us. Do you think because you were young, perhaps they were like, oh, you know, you're healthy, a young, healthy woman, like it's just your first pregnancy.
I think it was a combination of what you're saying. And also too, I was Latina on Medicaid benefits. I think they, at the same time, you know, they get so inundated with other patients in the emergency room and other departments that they're just like, all right, let's get this one out of here. This is just, you know, commonalities to this and that. So it was definitely a combination of a lot of stuff. So I ended up going to the doctor's office that morning, and it was me and my children's father, and he pulled me into his office, not your regular, you know, room to check you out or nothing. And he just sits me down and I'm just like, okay, this is really not good. I can already feel it. Like my heart is racing. And he's like, Yanela, and the doctor too that I was seeing, he was Cuban too. So I felt really comfortable around him. And he looks at me, he's like, I don't know how to explain this to you. I don't know what happened here, but your ultrasound showed that your baby has this condition called fetalis hydrops or fetal hydrops. And I'm like, okay, break it down in lame term language, you know, basic language. He's like, basically it's a condition where, the baby in utero has this compressing amount of fluid in her organs that it's not letting the baby's organs develop or even function. And I was like, okay, is that why my belly looks like 5,000 times bigger than what it should? He was like, yeah, that fluid is also building up around your cavity, your uterus, and it looks like it's backflowing into your lungs, which then in turn is making your heart weaker. And I'm like, whoa.
Finally, some answers.
Right. He was dumbfounded, to be honest with you. He didn't understand because he's the one that gave me the clearance to go to Cuba, and he did a full workup, and he was like, "You're fine. You're fine in my eyes to give you the go, you know?" So he immediately sent me across the street to another medical pavilion. He's like, "You're going to go to a high-risk physician. They're going to do a procedure that's called amniocentesis, where they stick like a huge needle like this in your belly, and they extract that fluid and they send it off to pathology to get tested to see where it's originating from, if it's a virus, if it's what." So I go across the street, I get that done, literally passed out because they didn't give me nothing to numb my belly. And mind you, the needle gauge was enormous. So it so happened that the doctor who was doing the procedure was going on a 2-week vacation.
Oh my
after
gosh.
That. So I wasn't going to get any results. So possibly 2, maybe even 3 weeks later.
There's literally nobody else.
Nobody else.
That's wild.
Now remember Medicaid. So with Medicaid, there's like a limited amount of people that'll take you, especially with high risk. So here I go back home. This time, I have finally graduated. I walked the stage barely with any energy, but I graduated very pregnant, and I got my diploma, and...
Yay!
Yeah. So, you know, that's how I should have been feeling, like, ecstatic over the roof that I did it, regardless of everything. And, my goodness, I think 2 weeks after, and now we're talking mid-June, back in the ER.
Same symptoms.
Same symptoms, but this time I'm really having full-blown, you know, unconscious syncope episodes.
Oh, my God.
And the doctor was called, and he was like, "We can no longer, you know, handle her case. She needs to go to another hospital, and her case needs to be transferred to a RIPIC doctor, which is essentially a high-risk obstetrics doctor." So I get transferred by fire rescue to the level one trauma center where they handle the high risk cases. And it just went downhill from there. Like every day, they thought that I was preeclemptic. They thought that, you know, my gosh, that I had, what was that? I forgot what they were saying. They literally tried to give me like 5 different diagnoses. And then they were giving me like a bunch of different electrolytes, magnesium, and everything just kept making me sicker and sicker. And I was literally just on the brink of no return and still pregnant. After I think like day 3, Pam, my body pretty much said, "Get this baby the hell out of me."
Did they ever tell you about the fluid?
No. Still nothing. The diagnosis was transferred over to the new hospital, but they didn't, since they already knew what it was, there was no point of testing it at that time.
Right.
It was just so chaotic. And by day 3, I started going into natural labor.
Whoa. How far along were you?
32 weeks.
Okay. So early.
Very early still. I was in the bed, and I have my children's father, my stepmom, and my dad, and I tell them, like, I just felt a big gush. The nurse comes in. She was like, "Oh, you just, you know, you urinated on yourself." And I'm like, no. This is different. Once again, Pam, they ignored me 3 times, and it kept leaking and leaking out. And then finally, I, you know, my family got really agitated because I was not only in labor, I was in pain, and they didn't think that my membranes had ruptured. They finally got another nurse who did the test strip, which if the test strip turned a specific color, then yes, it was confirmed. But even the test strip testing that color, they didn't pay attention to that because they thought it was because of that fluid.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they thought that the fluid was triggering the strip to be testing blue, which is supposed to confirm the amniotic fluid membranes rupturing. So they ended up sending the fluid to test.
While you're in pain, literally.
While I'm literally in pain. The doctor finally comes in and he checks me. He's like, you're 5 centimeters dilated. This baby is coming. And I'm like, give me something for pain. Give me an epidural. Give me something. By the time the anesthesiologist came and the entire team was there, I was already full-blown dilated. I was feeling, you know, the readiness to push. And I delivered her naturally. And she not only was coming head first, but she was coming with a shoulder dystocia, with her shoulder like this.
Oh, my gosh.
She tore me up immediately. Yeah. They said, here's your baby. Bam. And took her. I didn't see her after that. As soon as I got fixed down there and sewn up, I went into full cardiac heart failure.
Oh, my gosh.
I felt like I couldn't breathe. It was just awful. They immediately rushed me into ICU.
In that case, ahí sí escucharon, ¿no?
They finally listened to me. They assigned a cardiologist who to this day is still the same cardiologist that I have, that he ordered like a bunch of testing, MRI, CT, ultrasound, and they finally discovered that I had a condition called peripartum cardiomyopathy, which is essentially it's a disease of the heart muscle where it's enlarged. And because your heart muscle gets so enlarged, it's harder for it to contract and pump the blood in your body. And on top of all the backflow that was going into my lungs, so my heart became so weak, it wasn't able to work whatsoever. So they finally discovered what was happening to me.
Oh my gosh.
So that's that part. As I'm trying to recover and go through all that, my baby is in the NICU. And I get a phone call. Mom, you need to come upstairs. The baby is not doing well. She is on life support right now. She's on a ventilator. I think you need to come upstairs and see what you want us to do and unfortunately make a tough decision.
You're 17 years old.
I'm 17 years old.
Oh my gosh. And like just came back alive, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Barely, to be honest with you. I think before I went upstairs to see what I needed to do, I remember there was a high-risk doctor, a maternity high-risk doctor that came in. I'll never forget his face. I did forget his name, unfortunately, because do you know how doctors come in and out and they check you out or whatnot? But he said to me, an African-American doctor, he said, let me tell you something. Somebody must have been watching over you because you should not be here. Your condition and the condition that your daughter is carrying, that is full maternal death. And
oh my gosh.
I was literally, I gave him the look of like, what? I just, I was so drugged up and he's telling me these things and I'm trying to like take in everything that is happening, not only to me, but then the call that I just had. So I get wheeled upstairs with all my IV pumps, with all the stuff that I had on me, I'm barely like awake. And I get upstairs to the NICU. And they're literally doing CPR on the baby. Oh,
as you arrive?
As I arrive. And I see her, she's in a diaper and her belly is like really inflamed because of the fluid. And as they're doing CPR, all the neonatologists are looking at me like, we've already done resuscitation for over 2 hours. Her heart keeps stopping. You tell us what you want us to do. We can continue the resuscitation efforts or we can stop. And he's like, on top of that, we keep draining the fluid from her abdomen, but it keeps reaccumulating. Yeah.
Wow.
Seeing my baby girl just pretty much lifeless and just flapping from all the CPR, and just seeing that there is no life in her, I told them to seize resuscitation efforts. And because of the hospital that I was in, it was Catholic as far as their faith-based, and I was raised in a Catholic faith-based home. They baptized her in front of me. And so they let me hold her, you know, right then and there. But then as I'm holding her, I passed out. So they took her off my hands. And they rushed me back down to the ICU because I was pretty much draining the can, sort of, you know, sort of say. And I'm back down in ICU. And when I thought that I was getting better, I got a little worse. You know, my heart started like failing a little bit more. And I think it was all relative to everything leading up to that, plus what I just had to endure.
Totally.
And they, about a couple of hours later, you know, they cleaned the baby up and they dressed her up. She looked like a beautiful little angel. And they brought her down to me and my entire, you know, they let more family come in to my particular room because of everything that had happened. Because ICU is pretty strict on visitation. I could not bear seeing my dead daughter in my hands that I, once again, I fainted. And my dad, you know, grabbed her and gave her back to the nurse. And, you know, I got so, like, angry when I finally regained consciousness that I felt like everything leading up to that very moment was robbed from me. Like the opportunity to be a mom, the opportunity to say my goodbyes, like everything. It was just traumatic and just mortifying. But after that, you know, after a couple of days more in the ICU, I finally got released. And it was terrible. It was, and I think I'm using the word terrible just to throw a word out there, but it was tough because I was on the second floor close to the maternity ward and the window was right next to me. And of course, when you've had enough and things are just still being thrown at you, like I would see fathers come in with their car seats and walk out with a baby. And I came in pregnant. I'm coming out not pregnant with no car seat. So it was just, it was horrible, but I had to live. I had to live and I had to bury my daughter. And I had the next journey of trying to see where do I go from here now, having this heart condition that almost killed me. And, from there, like, I went to the cardiologist's office pretty much every 2 weeks after that for about a year or so. And my cardiologist, you know, till this day, I owe him my life because I don't think I've ever had, well, at least up until now that I'm more mature and I know how to choose my physicians better. He saved me and he was very strict on me and he had no filters. He would tell me like, do not get pregnant again. You are playing the Russian roulette with your life. And while he was absolutely right about that, I became severely depressed after that entire experience.
Of course.
You know, I became a little bit naive and almost like ignorant to my heart problem. And I unexpectedly got pregnant about a year and 2 months later after that. Meanwhile, I am trying to get my heart back to some state of normality. I'm on heart medication. I'm on a low sodium diet. But all that still wasn't enough to cause such a significant alarm to kind of band-aid what I wanted and what I felt, you know, that I was robbed of, that I became pregnant again. And Pam, let me tell you something. When I had to go back to the cardiologist's office and confess to him that I was expecting,
You passed out again.
He looked at me with these big bug eyes and he was like, "You're joshing me, right?" I said, "No, I'm sorry." Oh. He's like, "Yanela, come on. We talked about this." And I said, "I'm sorry, but I really want to be your mom." I became almost like fixated on the ideology of wanting to be a mother as young as I was, because now I'm like almost 19. But even then, so life after that consisted of nothing but cardiology appointments. I had to go now to a high risk center to get checked out every 2 weeks. So it was literally week one, cardiologist, week two, OBGYN checkup. That was my entire pregnancy up until the point that I once again went into preterm labor, but this time at 34 weeks. My body said, Yeah, I lasted a little longer, but meanwhile, during that particular pregnancy with my daughter, Leah, who's almost 15 in a couple of days, they put me on a heart transplant waiting list.
Wow.
Yeah. He said, you know, I have to play this very safe because your heart endured such a weakness and such failure that if we don't take precautionary measures, we might just lose you entirely. And if I can get you on the heart transplant list, and if we get to that level, because again, I didn't let my heart heal. I mean, literally a year and 2 months later, I got pregnant again, once again, causing a strain on it. So he did that just to be safe.
I have questions. So do you ever think that your first daughter saved you?
Yes. I do, and I hate to say that, but it's the truth. I think she did in so many ways.
Yes. I as you were telling this story, I'm like, oh, she was probably like, you know what? I'm going to raise this alarm so they can finally listen to her. Oof. Oh, so touching. And thank you for sharing that story. Why getting pregnant again affects the heart so much in your case. So how are you going to get it back to healthy without getting pregnant? And how, like, what's the correlation with, like, don't get pregnant because we're trying to get your heart back to the healthiest?
Right. So anytime a woman gets pregnant, I think they don't realize that everything is heightened. Everything is increased, doubled, even tripled sometimes. Like, you know, not only are you intaking a higher amount of food to, you know, create energy for yourself, and then you're growing baby inside, your blood volume doubles, the oxygen demand in the body doubles, everything. And then on top of all that, all your organs are literally mushed up into like a little space in your thoracic cavity where it's like everything is barely functioning as it is. So with my particular case, because I already had that diagnosis, my heart was already weak as it is. And now that I'm putting it once again into this state of almost like a heightened demand for it to work and keep me alive and keep this baby alive that I'm expecting, it was like my heart was running a marathon that was never going to end. And it was rough. And you know, not for nothing, there was like other restrictions too. You know, I got to be careful with what I eat. I can't be like your everyday expectant mom and just, oh, I'm craving this, I want to eat this and that. No, I had to be so careful with what I ate because anything that was too heavy on salt would trigger, you know, my blood pressure going up, which then triggered more things. Then if I ate something fattening, that was even worse because now I'm gaining more unnecessary weight, which more weight, more, you know, yeah, everything. It was like I was treading carefully with everything.
For sure.
So every time that, you know, I became pregnant, it was just like I don't know. I guess the whole concept of the cardiomyopathy is, gosh, I do truly have a big heart, because my heart really did go through unbearable strains out of my own neglect and naiveness, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, and also you were ignored by doctors. I think it's also important to remind the medical world, because you were really young. Is this something that you were born with, that was developed? How? Because you were super young.
Oh, yeah, I was very young. It took quite some time for me to really come to an understanding and kind of dig into my own, you know, medical past as far as like my family goes. When I got pregnant with my son, that's when things finally started coming to light, because I started asking my family and I'm like, you know, there has to be a correlation there. You know, I was literally a healthy Latina. I was doing weightlifting, running track. I was even at, you know, you can even consider me a tomboy, to be honest with you. And finally my mom shares with me that, oh, your aunt, her sister, had the cardiomyopathy and had the exact same things I had, but the only difference is her, all her pregnancies were viable and they lived. And I'm like, ay, Dios mío, mommy, you know, you could have shared this with me very early on in life. So it became hereditary.
Wow. One thing that I learned is that on average, Hispanic women are likely to develop heart disease 10 years earlier than non-Hispanic women. Just fascinating to me. I wonder why. I couldn't find out why, but I was like, And only 1 in 3 Hispanic women are aware that heart disease is their number one killer.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know that until now. Like, it's a thing.
It truly is a thing, and it's a evolving thing, and it's become more and more frequent in the Latina population, because I think it goes back to what I was sharing earlier. I think that they're ignored. I think they're ignored, and I think, not for nothing, like, Latina women are always on the go. They're always on the go, and they're so strong and resilient, and they don't necessarily like harness specific things. Like, for example, you know, all we think about is trying to make ends meet, get a good career, make sure your household is good and taken care of, that you put yourself in a back burner all the time, all the time.
All the time.
So we really don't pay attention to those little details. You know, we have our children, we do what we need to do, and we keep it moving. And then next thing you know, we're literally the cause of our own demise.
For sure. So now that you have 2 children now, right?
Yeah.
And they're healthy and fine. Were both pregnancies early?
They were both emergency C-sections. My son was also 34 weeks. Both the babies were 5-pound babies. So I think if I would have held them to full term, they would have been nice hefty babies. But yeah, during both times, Pam, my body literally said, we can't do this anymore. And they just, that's it.
Wow. Bodies are so awesome. I think, I mean, especially women's bodies, because you literally create humans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is like wild. I mean, it's pretty cool. So now that, you know, you have your diagnosis, how do you maintain a healthy support for your heart? What is it that you need to do? Did your lifestyle change? Do you have to do, of course, visits to the cardiologist? But
yeah, there's a lot of things. Like, after even I decided to kind of stop reproducing and got my tubes tied, and I said, that's enough. I've been blessed with both a boy and a girl. It's time for me to really just appreciate what I have and just take care of myself, because now they need me, right? So what I ended up doing is really just truly making a drastic lifestyle change. Kind of started doing more cardio, more walking, just being mindful of pretty much everything I eat. And I'm a foodie. I love food. I mean, I love food, which is really unfortunate, because now I have to really just kind of fine tune everything that I eat. And if I do eat what I love, it's not going to taste the same because I can't put all the good seasoning in it. So yeah, it's just truly just being careful with everything. And I think one of the most important things for not only myself and all women to think about is just, how do you really be true to yourself and just true to your body and just listen to it? You know, I think after all these years of going through that, I think any single time that I feel something and I see it becoming more consistent, then I'm like, okay, something is up. Now, if it's a one and done, fine, no big deal. We can, you know, take a look at that if it happens again. But if there's a consistency in how I'm feeling, I'm not ignoring it anymore. And when I go to the doctors now, you better be prepared because you're going to have 5,000 million questions and I'm going to expect some answers and I'm going to expect some expertise and care. You're not going to brush me off like the old naive Yanela. So it's definitely different. And then because of everything that happened to me, Pam, my family really did get scared. I mean, scared significantly to where now they are very cautious of how they take care of themselves.
Okay.
It's been very bittersweet, sort of say. But I think because of everything, they're more aware and in tune themselves as well. I think there's also that ignorancy of like, oh, if it happened to Yanela, who was like 17 years old, healthy, una loquita, you know, like it can happen to us and we're like this age. So it definitely was a scare for everybody.
For sure. And I mean, yes, I'm with you on like the bittersweet moment of when you're in it, really unfortunate. And after the fact, it gives perspective of, well, what are we going to do to make sure that we're not back at this hospital with somebody else? Because it was, I mean, it sounds frightening and even frustrating and sad, you know? And so it's those moments many times that bring families together and kind of like shift the perspective of lifestyle.
Oh, yeah.
So what would you say to women who are kind of like, oh, should I go get checked? Maybe I've been feeling something because, so I'll share a quick story that happened to me last year, actually. So I woke up in the middle of the night with my left arm numb and I couldn't breathe. And I was like, oh, this is not normal. I need to figure it out. So my Apple Watch actually, like I saw my heart rate and it was like 140 beats per minute, which is not normal at a resting state. And so I was like, oh, this is not like I get to 150 when I'm on my bike, you know, like this
is
me waking up with 140. Like, what is this? And so I drank some water, went to the bathroom, and I was still feeling pretty like disconnected. It was almost like I was disconnected from the world. Like I was detached, you know, and my arm was numb and I was like, oh, this is not normal. And so I took myself to the ER and they triaged me for heart attack and stroke or. And they gave me an aspirin and then went through every single test that you can imagine, CT scans, MRI, like ultrasound, all of them. And they found nothing. So the conclusion is that I had a TIA and like someone was like, are you having a panic attack? And I'm like, I don't think a panic attack would like numb my arm.
Let alone wake you up in the middle of the night.
Right. Like, I don't know. And so there's actually like all the results of the test. I need to go back to get further answers. Actually, you're making me think on it because everything was inconclusive. Literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had neuro, like doctors were coming in and out. Like I was literally that, like I felt like a lab rat because doctors were coming in and out of my room and they were like talking to each other and they were like so confused. And then at some point, this one doctor said I had a murmur in my heart. And then another one came and they were like, no, that's not right. we don't hear it. And I'm like, I just need to know what's wrong. And literally they kept me for 2 nights. And then after that, you're like, you're good to go. We found nothing.
Yeah. And that's the part where this Yanela here now would be like, yeah, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing that because what I experienced was real. And yeah. There is no need for me to waste my time and come into the ER and share with you all and explain to you what happened to me. And you're telling me that it was just a TIA. I don't know about that. But going back to what you asked, I think for all women, especially, you know, I'm a big champion for minority women because apart from the fact that there's so much stigma around their care and, you know, there's a lot of disproportionate disparities in a lot of communities. And of course, you know, the insurance plays into it. The white coat syndrome of physicians plays into it. I would say to all the women out there to just don't take no for an answer. Just really like be combative. Be combative and be your own advocate and champion yourself to take care of yourself to a point that you know what you're feeling. You know what you're experiencing. Do not allow yourself to fall into the rippling cracks of stereotypes and statistics and just fight, like really fight the system, fight the people in the system and just be your own advocate. Stay in tune with your body and don't take no for an answer. Just really probe everything.
I agree. I'm gonna go back and get more tests done. I've been feeling great actually. So I went back made some changes in my lifestyle and got to moving my body more. And I was, of course, careful with like not stressing my heart too much, but it was really interesting. I told a friend of mine and she was like, what happened that day that was different from your life that you don't normally do? And I got a massage that day when I have that. Earlier that day before it happened. And she was like, well, she knows two people who've gotten massages and the aorta on the neck, the person who did the massage, like there's this like tiny, I guess a tiny bubble that could be created from like a massage that's not done correctly. And so she was like, could have that, like maybe, you know, if it was like such a tiny, like who knows, but it's a, like, who knows, you know?
Right. But then again, if you go back for another massage, are you going to experience the same thing? Right. So that's why you need answers. You see?
Yes, 100%. Well, you know, thank you so much for coming to Kava Kumbam and sharing your story. Definitely. You're leaving me absolutely with some thoughts on taking care of myself more, advocating for myself, asking questions, going back for answers when the questions are not answered. Because, I mean, who else is going to advocate for us if not us? So thank you for sharing all the things. Last few questions. Do you have a remedio that you want to share with us?
Oh, let's see. Oh my goodness, I have so many, but one of the ones that I still use to this day, and I am going to pass it down because it came from my mom and her grandmother, is tilo leaves, which is linden tree.
Oh.
And yes, so my mom, when we moved up to Palm Beach County, when we migrated, she finally found a linden tree and she planted it in a huge pot in the backyard. And every time I would have like an upset stomach or I was getting sick or even having menstrual cramps, she would say, snatch a couple of the leaves from the fetal tree, boil it up. And once you see the water turn like a very gold color, drain out the leaves. Add a poquito of azúcar, sugar, or maybe some honey if we had some. take it all down. And I kid you not, to this day, it is so effective. And I sleep like a baby.
All right. Noted. Thank you for that. Do you have a productivity tip, trick, or tool that you want to share with us?
Yeah, I've learned the hard way never to set goals, because I feel like even though it's a short-term goal, yeah, sometimes those short-term goals can alter the long-term ones. So I said to myself, no more goal setting. We're just going to ride this journey all the way to the end, if there has an end to it, because some journeys don't. So I always said that. Learn the hard way, right. But it's been very effective. So
I love that. And tell us about 2024 Go Red for Women class.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. Oh God, I'm so excited. So the 2024 Go for Red Women class of survivors is a group of us, 12 in total, different women from different walks of life, seasons, ages, cultures, backgrounds, you name it, who all have experienced something so profound with heart disease or stroke. And of course, you have to go through a whole application process and vetting, because it's a national application to be part of this. And, you know, I was chosen. I've been doing work and, you know, volunteer work with the American Heart Association since 2017. So we're so excited because the group is going to be announced on February 1st to the world. And we're going to just be champion heart disease and stroke. And we're literally just going to be the voice of women. We're literally going to echo everything and anything related to those two conditions.
I love that. Tell us all the places and spaces where we can find you and find out about the 2024 Go Red for Women class.
So, of course, social media. I'm on Facebook, Yanela Vickers. And then I am on Instagram, Y_V112. And then also, you can definitely go to the American Heart Association Go for Red Women website, and you'll see us there. And then also to Facebook. They have a couple of pages for the Go for Red Women. And then, of course, as things move along, we'll definitely be participating in different platforms with different sponsors, just to share the message and be champions for heart awareness and stroke.
Yay! Amazing! Well, thank you so much for coming to Café con Pam and for your work and for bringing awareness to such important issue, because it is a big deal. Given that I experienced something with my heart, it's a big deal.
Stay shining, guys and gals!
All right, listeners, that was my conversation with Yanela. I hope you enjoyed it and learned from her experience. And maybe we planted that seed for you to take action and take care of your health and prioritize it. Super important to do so. If this is your first time here, welcome to Café con Pam. I hope you stay. I hope you subscribe, follow on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and whatever platform you use to listen to podcasts. You can also download the Latina Podcasters Network app to discover other podcasters like this one. And listeners, this is my invitation for you to drop some stars, leave a review, anything that you can, if you feel called to support us. A great way to do so free is to drop some stars and or leave a review. It really does make a difference. I know some people say it doesn't matter. However, 87% of the population look at reviews before making a decision. Thank you so much for those of you who will take the time to drop some stars and those of you who take the time to leave a review. So appreciate you taking the time. It means so much. I look, literally, it's part of my morning routine to look at new reviews and new stars. So I so appreciate you. Anytime I see new ones pop in to the apps and the platforms. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's stay connected. Of course, follow on social media at Café con Pam Podcast, at Café con Pam Pod on TikTok, Café con Pam on YouTube. If you are on the tube, subscribe, like, drop a comment. Also means a lot when you drop your comments, leave us your thoughts. Let's stay connected online,
Also, check out cafecompam.com. Check out the Manny's Pass, cafecompam.com/Manny's Pass. And this is a place where you can get unstuck, find clarity, get things done. We tap a lot, and I give you office hours. I give you my time. I show up for office hours, and we have weekly cafecito, which is super fun. One of my favorite calls of the week. We get to hang out. It's really awesome. You wanna listeners, thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate you taking your time, lending me your ears and your time and your space to hang out with you. See you next week. Y como siempre, stay shining. Sabrosura, papi, que, que.